This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, as usual. Our first guest I'm pleased to have is our Dr. Eli Carmon. He's an Israeli political scientist and senior researcher currently at the International Institute for Counterterrorism and a senior research fellow at the Institute for Policy and Strategy of the Interdisciplinary Center at Herzliya in Israel, obviously, and he's speaking to us from there. And he speaks and lectures on terrorism and guerrilla warfare in modern times, and his degrees in Israel at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and Haifa University. And he has various other efforts, including, and I find this fascinating, he has spent some time at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which is an interesting place to park your hat, I think. I'm being a little flip, but you know what I mean. The War College in Carlisle, for those who don't know it, the cream of the American Army gets to go there, and they study strategy, not just tactics, but they study broad strategy, and they think through. I suspect their curriculum reaches all the way back to Thucydides and right up to the current day, the current era, in an effort to understand the nature of strategic engagements. Dr. Carmon, please, I'm pleased to have you with us. This most recent Middle East conflict, at least now, at the moment while we're recording this conversation, is in a mode of ceasefire. But one of the most pressing questions that people are evaluating and trying to answer, and there are several questions, obviously, is who won in this confrontation, and what are the future possible avenues? What's going to come out of this? Ceasefire really take hold, or will Iran return to its apparent intention to end up as the globe's next nuclear power? And I think also, was the American engagement at the end of it with the strategic bombing of the three nuclear sites, was it significant? Was it crucial? Or did it not matter? And was it a net positive? Or was it something that added further complications to the circumstances? Dr. Carmon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Brooks, for having me. You mentioned period I passed in 2008 at the Carlisle barracks in Pennsylvania. I was supported by this institution, honorable institution, just to write a book about exactly the subject relevant today. The coalition between Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas. And I decided to consider it a natural coalition, and to try to understand why it works. And it worked. We see that it worked since the four actors in this alliance, this coalition, which lately has become the axis of resistance, began to challenge Israel during all this period. But in the last 2 years, they tried practically to destroy Israel physically, beginning it in Gaza with Hamas, then continuing immediately with Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis, the various militias, pro-Iranian militias in Syria and in Iraq, and also the regime in Syria, which was allied with the Iranians since 1980. Now, the issue of the result of the bombings and the military activity, not only the air activity, but also on the ground activity, because it appears that not only the Mossad, but also Israeli military commandos were on the ground there, not far from the various objectives. And just in these minutes, we have the Secretary of Defense of the United States and the Chief of Staff of the United States presenting on TV what, according to them, are the results of this operation, which is a joint venture, if you want, between Israel and the United States. And according to most, I think, to most of the evaluations, this was a very significant hit to all the or the main nuclear and also missiles, long-range missiles, objectives of the Israeli and American coalition. First of all, in Natanz and Isfahan, and then in Fordow, where Israel at the beginning was not perhaps directly active, but the final hit came from the United States B-2 bombers. Now, in order to know exactly what happened on the ground, what are the results, especially to understand what happened with the 450 kilograms of enriched uranium, which everybody knew, including the IAEA or the international community, we have to wait a bit because there are difficulties in the case of war, and now the inspectors are not on the ground to understand exactly what were the effects. But as I said, the Isfahan and the Natanz and the Fordow facilities are destroyed. Now, the question is, as I said, the fate of the enriched uranium. And the main issue is, will the Iranian regime accept to negotiate? Because we need to finish this kind of war with an agreement which will be much more comprehensive, much more strict than the one achieved by the President Obama in 2015. And with the monitoring, continuing monitoring of the international community, and probably also the intelligence agencies of Israel, United States, and the other Western countries.
Let me jump in here. You say it should be the following kinds of things, and it should be stricter than the 5+1 accord from 2016,
15,
2017,
15.
15. Sorry, I'm having a little trouble in keeping track of all this these days. But that accord worked for some time, and the evaluations were that the Iranian nuclear impulse was stilled for a while. Once Donald Trump removed the American participation, it meant that the door was much wider, much more open. And now the process is putting that, to mix metaphors, putting that genie back in the bottle again. But will the quite you say should. Now the question is, will the Iranians do this? Will they go along with it? Or will they feel that it is even more imperative on them to figure out some way to make use of that missing 400 kilograms of U-235 for perhaps a dirty bomb? Will they acquiesce in the idea that their nuclear ambitions are put back in the box?
You must understand why the 2015 JCPOC agreement or deal was not good, because it only challenged the issue of the nuclear project in very general ways, without much dealing into details, because many details were not known. Some of the installations or the facilities were discovered even later. But it didn't touch all the industry of long-range missiles and all the regional subversive activity and terrorist activity of Iran in the Middle East, the building of this axis of resistance and terrorism globally, practically everywhere. Because President Obama was convinced at that time that the agreement will bring the moderate part of the regime in power, and everything will be rosy, and there will be a change inside the Iranian regime itself. And it didn't ha happen. On the contrary, it became much more radical. Now, this part, for instance, there were only 800 personalities and installations that were freed from sanctions, including all the leaders known of the revolutionary Islamic forces, including Qasem Soleimani, which was later killed by the Americans under President Trump's order. And they continue to subvert the region and to try to achieve the destruction of Israel. Now, for the moment, there is no agreement even on this phase. I mean, it is an oral agreement between President Trump, the leader of Qatar, and the leader, we don't know exactly which leader of Iran. So something must be written in detail, and especially we have to see if the Iranian regime will accept the request by President Trump to renounce completely enriched uranium on its territory. to destroy everything that is already there or to export it to other countries, for instance, to Russia, and then to finish any attempt to return to enrichment of uranium.
Let me interrupt for a sec. My understanding of the 5+1 agreement was specifically designed to be limited to the nuclear question at hand, rather than the broader set of difficult and important questions that you identify, the missiles and then broader terrorist activity and so forth. But even somebody like Brent Scowcroft, who is hardly a soft touch for, or was hardly a soft touch for, you know, for the easy solution, pretty hardcore individual, even he admitted that the agreement was useful, not totally all-encompassing, but useful, and that it could have set in motion the possibilities of further agreements. The question now, though, is with Syria having changed its government, with Hamas at great cost has been largely smashed, Hezbollah is a spent force, the Iranian alliance system appears much less strong than it was 4, 5, 6 years ago. And if that's true, does that give an opportunity for the Iranians to move in the direction of saying, let us negotiate further, or does it make them more obdurate and insistent that they will move ahead regardless of circumstances? I'm trying to focus on the future question rather than litigate over whether or not the 5+1 agreement was good enough or just good enough or not good enough.
Look, I was one among a long list of experts, military academicians also, which were not happy with the agreement. But we understood that at that moment, there was no other choice because this was the decision of President Obama. And indeed, permitted the international community of Israel to try to survive until to 2030 and to see how the regime will change in Iran. But we saw that the regime indeed became more and more radical and made every possible effort in order to advance its destructive strategy. Now, it is true that the President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu, which was much more opposed to the agreement than most of the, I would say, professionals in Israeli establishment, he convinced President Trump to cancel American participation. This permitted the Iranians, especially because President Biden did not, during his presidency, make any, I would say, aggressive attempts against Iran to rush to the nuclear bomb. And this became very, very recently a serious problem, especially after the beginning of the war in Gaza and the war in Lebanon and the war with the Houthis.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And we're speaking now with Dr. Eli Carmon. We're talking about the future movement between Israel and Iran and whether or not something could be hammered together that will be more comprehensive and longer term and more peacemaking as opposed to what we have just seen. Will the ceasefire hold and will we go forward? We'll be back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest, Dr. Eli Carmon, and we're talking about the difficulties with the previous P5+1 agreement with Iran over nuclear issues. But I'm posing to my guest the question of now what happens? Where do we go from here? Because we can't forever litigate what happened in the past with the original agreement. And my guest is saying there needs to be a more comprehensive approach that doesn't just talk to nuclear potentials. It talks to missiles. It talks to terrorist activity. It talks to all manner of things. And I think I'm paraphrasing you correctly. And if that's true, how will the Iranians respond to this if such initiatives are beginning to be pushed in their direction? What happens next?
We have a response today. Ayatollah Khamenei already declared, we'll not renounce our project, we'll continue to defy the United States and Israel, and practically continuing the aggressive stance. The question is, if indeed he is controlling, continues to control, we don't know, if he continues to control all the military and the scientific establishment, we know that they are very much afraid that I would say the catastrophe, the military catastrophe could produce not a change of regime immediately, but at least manifestations and opposition. We know there is a huge opposition inside Iran, not from today, not only by the middle class and all the women, but also the minorities in the Kurdish, in the Baluchi, in the Arab provinces. So they have to take care now for their stability and even their survival. So therefore, I think they are trying to show that they are still very strong on the ground. Their propaganda declares that we won the war, not the Israeli, not the Americans, and trying to minimize the challenges, although they recognize, by the way, at least officially, that the nuclear project was seriously hit. They said about it at a very official level. So I think already there is a kind of a hint by President Trump, I think, today, and by the Prime Minister, that if they will not return to the negotiation table and will not accept in the time the strict conditions that President Trump asked, there is a possibility of a new round of conflict, military conflict. And because their air defenses and most of their leadership, military leadership, was neutralized, they will have difficulty to continue to be stubborn. I think so.
I tend to think that the current leader echo of the way Donald Trump conducts his public statements and his responses. Donald Trump is given to making all manner of statements in all kinds of directions, many of which turn out to contradict the ones he made the day before. And not all of them result in actual policy changes. And I'm beginning to think that the current leaders in Iran are putting on the bravest possible face in the face of what is now their current adversity in order to make themselves feel better about how this has come out and what they should do. Do you really think that if they, I know they have said they're no longer going to, the Iranian parliament's no longer, it doesn't wish to follow the dictates of the non-proliferation treaty. Do you really think the Iranians will go forward and try to rebuild their nuclear program in some way, shape, or form? Or will that doorway open a bit more for torturous, prolonged, difficult negotiations over the panoply of questions that we've been talking about?
I think that they will return to negotiations. They don't have much choice. But the question is, if there is some secret installation that nobody knew in the West, including in Israel, and there is a relatively big quantity of enriched uranium that they have succeeded in hiding, in principle, they have the knowledge to rush to try to build a military device for their already active missiles. We saw that they have very, very strong missiles. By the way, their missiles reach Europe today. It's not only against Israel. They are building also 2,500 long-range missiles, which will cover most of the Europe and Asia. And like the North Koreans, they will try to challenge the American territory. This is their plan. It's not only to attack Israel. So they will engage. The question is if there will be sufficient intelligence on our part that indicates that they are trying to cheat during the negotiations. I think there will be another attack by the Israeli or the American-Israeli coalition.
That response, I think, qualifies as a possibilities are endless. There are some good possibilities and there are some very not so good possibilities.
It's open at this moment, I would say.
Yeah, as somebody said, predicting the future is much harder than predicting the past.
I would like the issue of regime change. I think that those who spoke that Israel will try to change the regime, and the war in Israel, people, including hints by the prime minister, that we try to change the regime. This is not an issue of 12 days or 3 or 4 weeks. But we know that in the regime there was a much more moderate branch which tried in 2015, 2016 to make a change. And most of their leaders, which were Islamists, Islamists in the Islamic establishment, they are today or for many years in a domiciliary arrest. Perhaps inside the establishment itself, it could be a change, not the public opinion, but inside the establishment itself, which will try to take advantage of them to bring them back and to show a more moderate face and try to be much more kind in the negotiations to challenge the threat, because there is a real threat, physical threat by Israel and the United States.
I like the phrasing you selected, which is change of regime. I've disagreed with the term regime change because it implies something that's easy and that the outsiders manage to pull off without much difficulty or anxiety. Change of regime strongly implies that individuals and organizations within a society attempt to change the way they are governed. It won't, if that were to happen in Iran, it would not be easy. It would not be simple. It certainly wouldn't be nonviolent. But there have been, as you note correctly, minority ethnicities in Iran that really don't like the regime very much at all. But a large chunk of the population is, after all, yearning for greater freedom of expression, greater economic opportunity, and less strong religious strictures on their everyday lives. And I think maybe, just maybe, this gives them hope rather than disheartens them.
Another comment. The Iranian public opinion was very worried that a change of regime could be very violent and bring chaos, like it brought in the Arab countries after the what was called the Arab Spring. But we have a very good example lately, the fall of the Bashar regime in Syria, which was sudden. And you see a new leadership, which, with all its problematics, as now cooperating with the United States and the European Union. And even they speak of perhams being part of the Abraham Accords. So this perhaps could happen in Iran, not in the same pace. And clearly there the minorities are much more stronger than the Kurds in Syria or the Druze in Syria. But this could be a kind of alliance of minorities with the middle class in Iran. And as I said, those moderates in the establishment, perhaps something could. And by the way, the first that tried to influence this trend is Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Shah of the Emperor of Persia, which perhaps knows something about it. We saw in Eastern Europe, for instance, some former kings being active during the fall of the communist empire and the attempt to democratize those countries.
Dr. Kamon, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Spector, for having me, and I am looking forward to continue the discussions.